I say, you know, how many of you support the Second Amendment? Every hand in the room goes up. And I say, how many of you support Article 2, Section 26 of the Arizona Constitution? And maybe one hand will tentatively go up. And then when I read them the language, they're like, I can't believe.
This is terrific.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Welcome back to the Kevin Roberts Show, still here in the great state of Arizona, and it is such a privilege to interview someone who is a real visionary for common sense thought, someone who has been really active in Arizona, and for that matter, in national legal thought, policy work for many decades, and he's still a young guy, Justice Clint Bowlick, Arizona Supreme Court. It's a real pleasure that you would take time out of your busy schedule to have this conversation.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for being in Arizona, and thank you for having this conference on education policy, which is, of course, an issue of great passion for me.
Indeed, and we will talk about that, both your own passion as well as the professional work you've done there to advance that great cause. But before we get into policy work, Justice. I'll call you Clint after that. I just want to do that once.
Clint is great. Thank you.
I'm always curious about people's personal story. And I happened to learn just last night when I was visiting with your wife that the two of you met because of heritage.
That is absolutely right. So Shauna was working at Heritage, and I was at the Institute for Justice, and I came over to Heritage for one of the famous free lunches that was on education policy, which was the area that she was working in. And wow, this actually gets really personal really fast, but she was sitting next to the speaker, and I emailed a few folks at Heritage afterwards and said, who is the goddess who is sitting next to Bruno Mano at the event today? And her boss happened to be at the event. She said, that's Shauna. And so we met through Heritage. We started dating in DC. She then moved to Texas to work for then Lieutenant Governor Rick Perry, but we eventually got together, got married in Washington, D.C., and she said, within a year, we're going to move to someplace where it never snows, and that turned out to be Phoenix, and now she's a state senator, and I'm on the court, and it's one of the many romances that were born at the Heritage Foundation.
What a great story. Thanks for sharing that.
Oh, my pleasure.
Heritage has a lot of influence. What is it like to tell people the greatest influence we have would be over stories like that?
Yes, absolutely.
And dozens of them, as you and Shauna no doubt know. So another aspect of your personal story, which I always try to get into in this show, is how you got to do what you're doing. I mean, and I want to get into in a little bit the daily life of a state Supreme Court justice, just because of my curiosity, which I presume some members of the audience will have too. But one way of asking this question, Clint, is in your wildest dreams, did you ever think you'd be doing what you're doing?
Absolutely not. And in fact, I decided to become a lawyer pretty late in my college career. I actually was going to be a teacher and go into politics. And there were a number of experiences that I had that kind of tilted me in the other direction. But one of them was taking a class in constitutional law. And I thought to myself, this is how you make a difference. This is how you make a difference without compromising your principles. You either win or you lose. And sometimes, like with a case like Brown versus Board of Education, you can have incredible systemic impact. So I decided to go to law school and ultimately was lucky enough to become a public interest litigator, founding the Institute for Justice, and then moving out here and joining the Goldwater Institute. But one of the things that happens along the line as a public interest litigator is you have to make peace with the fact that you will never be a judge. I can only think of two other public interest litigators who became became judges, and this is the only way that I'm in their company, and that's Thurgood Marshall and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But the fact that there are only two I can think of just shows that it's really the exception to the rule. And I published a book at the Cato Institute called David's Hammer, The Case for an Activist Judiciary. An intentionally provocative subtitle.
Particularly at Cato.
Yes, exactly. And I remember David Bowes saying, you have to tone down the subtitle. And his ace in the hole was, with that subtitle, you will never become a judge. And I said, David, I'm never going to become a judge anyway. And of course, when I applied for the Arizona Supreme Court, I was Governor Doug Ducey's first appointee. That, of course, was a point of significant controversy that I had written a book with that subtitle. So the answer is no, never in my wildest dreams. I had never aspired to it or even considered it within the realm of possibility, but it has been a fantastic experience.
So you were appointed to the court and then won a full term. But before you were appointed to the court, you had been at Goldwater, you had started Institute for Justice, but along the way, you also came to know U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
That's right.
You worked together.
Yes. Yes, at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. He was chairman. As a young lawyer, I went to work there. We got to know each other. We nerded out over constitutional issues, both of us wanting to overturn the slaughterhouse cases. Only your truly constitutional nerd viewers will appreciate that. Just became very good friends. He became the godfather to my second son. And in fact, I brought him, he was speaking at the Heritage Foundation one time, and I brought my summer intern. By that point, I was working at the Justice Department in the Reagan administration, and I brought my intern over to hear him speak, and that intern was John F. Kennedy Jr. And that night, Clarence called and he said, "Was that the son of the president that you introduced me to?" Virginia knew right away, but it took Clarence a while to figure out what intern it was that I was introducing him to. So another Heritage connection there.
So thanks for being willing to share the personal stories. I'm curious about what you think is the first big case or first big topic that you covered in the first part of your career.
So there really were two twin passions that I had. One was freedom of enterprise, which was intended to be a core protection of the 14th Amendment, but has become judicially our least protected right. So I took on the cause of a shoeshine artist in Washington, D.C., Ego Brown, and many other cases since then, trying to restore protection to the right to earn an honest living. And the other was school choice, coming from my past as wanting to be a school teacher, seeing how awful the conditions are for so many of the kids in our society, and being introduced to the ideas of Milton Friedman. And I made a commitment that I would defend school choice programs if they ever came to pass, and eventually they did.
Let's talk about the freedom of enterprise issue. Since you got involved in that initial case, has the situation there improved or worsened?
So it's definitely improved. For just to give you an example, Arizona passed licensing reciprocity for almost every occupation, so that if you're licensed in Minnesota and move to Arizona, you don't have to pass the licensing exam and that sort of thing. It's been especially helpful for military spouses, but for others as well. We had such a balkanized economy in that regard. But it's become an issue that's actually straddled the ideological divide. Of all people, Barack Obama got very involved in the occupational licensing issue from a very different perspective. He wanted former convicts once they had served their terms to be able to get jobs. And these licensing laws were keeping them out of entry-level jobs. So at the Institute for Justice, we made common cause with the Obama administration on that issue. As far as court victories, though, they are still slow in coming. And a number of federal courts have applied greater scrutiny to economic regulations than before. But the victory in the U.S. Supreme Court is yet to come. But legislatively, it's a much improved situation.
So this is a question both about the particular but also about the general. And that is, on this particular matter of freedom of enterprise, given the legislative momentum, if you will, does that, both in your experience but also in history, suggest a greater likelihood that there will be an ultimate U.S. Supreme Court victory?
Absolutely. And in fact, Antonin Scalia had a debate before he even became a circuit court judge, when he was Professor Scalia, against Professor Richard Epstein on this very subject, with Epstein arguing for greater protection for economic liberty, and Scalia being very sympathetic but being much more guarded. And Scalia said some words that I'll never forget. He said, the first thing that we have to do is to establish an ethos of economic liberty, and then further victories will follow. And I think he's absolutely right. And I think that groups like Heritage, the Institute for Justice, and so many of the state-based think tanks have established the proposition that these economic barriers really hurt the poorest people in our society the most. And that has, I think, really driven the legislative momentum. Courts don't like to do bold and risky things. And they would rather follow public opinion than lead public opinion in most instances. And so I think that those legislative victories are paving the way for hopefully a litigation victory down the line.
And it strikes me that there is a parallel with school choice. That is to say, there's an emerging ethos of parental freedom, of school choice. As we sit here, 25 states plus DC have some form of school choice, as you no doubt know. 10 of them, and we'll soon add another with Alabama, are universal education savings accounts, an idea that was born here.
Yes.
In Arizona. I can only imagine, and I ask you about the jurisprudence to the extent that you can discuss that, but the question really is, I imagine when you were heading litigation at Goldwater, you might not have imagined that this day would come quickly.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And obviously COVID was a huge driver for creating more freedom of choice in the educational sector. But yeah, momentum was very, very slow at the beginning. And interestingly, education savings accounts came out of a judicial defeat. My court, long before I was on it, in fact, I argued these issues before the Arizona Supreme Court, struck down school vouchers under the state constitution. And one of the justices posed a question to the teachers' union lawyer. He said, what if the money didn't just go to private schools, but it went to students and they could use it for any educational expenses? And the teachers' union lawyer said, that would be okay. So we go back to the office and we're like, you know what? We didn't think things went too well. Well, what about this idea that Justice Hurwitz, now judge on the Ninth Circuit, Hurwitz was asking about? And that's where the idea of education savings accounts were born. And as we thought about it, we're like, this is much better than vouchers, because instead of just focusing on tuition, it provides for a range of educational opportunities for kids, including now micro schools and education therapy and literally anything. It's the most individualized form of education policy that we've ever seen. But it was actually born out of a legal defeat. And that's one of the mottos that I've always followed is there is no permanent defeat. You just regroup and you try to move forward. And in that instance, it was, I think, a far superior idea that, as you pointed out, is really now sweeping the country.
And I am convinced that that momentum will continue. But just to geek out with you a little bit, policy guy to policy guy, it also is a model for how we might tackle the broad and expensive American safety net system. And to posit one idea we're batting around at Heritage, although Milton Friedman discussed a version of this, something called family savings accounts, something that's linked from an education savings account all the way through retirement, through Social Security. And I want your idea about that in particular, but part B of that is, and this is where your inner libertarian may go a little crazy, full disclosure, we're trying to figure out what to do with the birth dearth and the social, economic, national security implications of a declining birth rate, and obviously, what is the role of the state, whether it be the Arizona state government mm-hmm. or the federal government, in helping to arrest that. We're not sure of the answer to that question mm-hmm. yet, but we're a think tank, so we're thinking on it. But the vehicle that we're really enamored with is this idea of this sort of personal savings account that goes through your life. Not necessarily asking for a legal opinion on that as much as to step into your policy mind and give us a view about where you think conservative, libertarian, right of center policy innovation is going.
Well, and you noted my inner libertarian, I think it's always important to fight within the realm of the possible and that to always be moving in the direction of freedom. So even if it's an incremental step, even school vouchers, charter schools were attacked as being, not nearly as radical as they should have been. So I have always been open to these ideas. And I think one example of that is housing vouchers that actually preceded school vouchers. And in fact, we often referenced housing vouchers as a predecessor to that type of idea. And when you think about it, I'm sure there are a lot of center-right people would say, gosh, what an awful idea. Why would we be doing that? Well, the alternative was, of course, these massive public housing projects that were an absolute disaster that guaranteed generations of poverty and that spawned breathtaking crime in the inner cities. And the dispersion of people, allowing them to use their aid as they best saw fit, I think was a step in the right direction. So the ideas that you're looking at right now, I think any incremental step to allow greater autonomy is a step in the right direction.
I'd forgotten about the housing vouchers, but those were huge. In fact, there are probably members of the audience too young to remember the scourge of inner city housing projects.
Yes.
And all of the problems that came from them. And I'm also reminded of the need to expand health savings accounts, right? This is the same kind of model, vital part of great policy innovation.
That's absolutely right. I think the medical savings accounts and health savings accounts are a great example of that step.
So we'll press pause on the geeking out on policy. And now I'm going to ask a curiosity question. I've been wanting to ask you this since we learned that you were going to be available for this interview. Just a very basic question. What's the daily life of a state Supreme Court judge?
Well, it really varies from day to day. But as you can imagine, there's just an amazing amount of reading that is required. The parties, submit their briefs. Our law clerks produce research. So more than anything else, it is either sitting at my computer reading things or reading vast notebooks because I am still a paper person.
I'm with you.
Good, good. But, You know, it's being on a state Supreme Court is, I think, second only to being on the United States Supreme Court in that our docket is largely discretionary. We have to take election cases and we have to take death penalty cases. But apart from that, we get to choose the cases that we are going to decide. And as a result, they typically are either issues that have divided the courts or super interesting and important issues. And so delving into the great legal issues of the day, it's just, it can't be beat. And the other thing that I really love about it, and I know this is not true of all courts, in fact, it's very untrue of some courts, but the collegial atmosphere in which we work is just amazing. We have decided some very divisive cases by 4-3 votes, and yet not once can I remember a cross word being spoken among the
That's
among
remarkable.
The justices.
Especially
it really
given
is.
Modern American
yes.
politics and discourse.
And I love that. You know, my mode has always been persuasion, not confrontation. And so it really works well with my personality and enjoying even, you know, people I disagree with being able to find common denominators and that sort of thing. So I juxtapose my daily life with my wife's daily life, where, as I said, I've never exchanged a crossword with one of my colleagues, even if I disagreed with them. And I don't think poor Shauna has ever had a day where she didn't exchange a crossword.
In the Arizona State Senate.
Yes, exactly.
Different ball of wax.
Exactly. So it's it's a great fit for both of our personalities, and I think we're both in a position to accomplish a great deal as a result.
And we're better off as a society because both of you do what you do.
Oh, thank you.
So what's the process for, given the discretion of the state Supreme Court, for deciding which cases to hear?
So it takes 3 votes out of our 7. On the U.S. Supreme Court, it's 4 out of 9 to take a case. We expanded since I joined. I joined a 5-member court, and it's expanded to 7. And at that point, it was 3 out of 5, and we kept it 3 even after we expanded to 7. And we get well over 1,000 petitions for review a year, and we take about 50 or 60 of those. We look and see, are these cases important? Are they easy cases that the lower courts can decide, or are they more challenging? And one thing that differs between the U.S. Supreme Court and state Supreme Courts, the U.S. Supreme Court, everyone has experience in constitutional law. That's actually atypical on state Supreme Courts. So I am the only constitutional lawyer on the court. And so when I see a case that raises a hot constitutional issue, you can be sure that I'm going to be trying to convince 2 of my colleagues to join me in taking the case. Then when I end up on the losing side, it really, it's disappointing. But nonetheless, you know, I'm always looking. State constitutionalism is far less developed than federal constitutional law. And I'm always looking for cases in which we can vindicate the guarantees of our state constitution.
What does the average observer, clearly a member of the audience, if they're hearing or watching this, need to know about American jurisprudence, about the judicial branch, that they may not know?
So really just picking up on my very last point, when we think of the Constitution, we think of the United States Constitution. And we actually have 51 constitutions, and our state constitutions were intended to be the primary source of our freedoms. It was only in the 1950s that that began to change. And they remain a potentially vibrant source of protections for our liberties. And as the U.S. Supreme Court grows more federalist in its decisions, obviously abortion is the one that comes to people's minds, but a whole host of issues are being either returned to the states or the U.S. Supreme Court is having more of a hands-off attitude toward state policy. The other thing that's really important to know about state constitutions, we are free as state judges to provide greater protections for individual rights than the U.S. Supreme Court does under the federal constitution, but not less. And I have always called that the freedom ratchet. So just to pick one example of many, eminent domain. The Institute for Justice litigated the infamous Kelo case up to the U.S. Supreme Court and lost under the U.S. Constitution. The very same time we were litigating in Arizona and other states with very similar cases and winning under the state constitutions. And gun rights, another example. It took the U.S. Supreme Court well over a century to recognize an individual right to keep and bear arms. That was fought over, for so long. Our state constitution says there is an individual right to keep and bear arms for defense of ourselves and for others. That issue was resolved in Arizona in 1912. And yet people, I often speak at groups and I say, how many of you support the Second Amendment? Every hand in the room goes up. Then I say, how many of you support Article 2, Section 26 of the Arizona Constitution? And maybe one hand will tentatively go up. And then when I read them the language, they're like, I can't believe.
This is terrific.
Yeah, exactly. So that would be the message that I would impart is the importance of state courts and the importance of state constitutions. We call ourselves federalists. We love to talk about federalism and devolving authority to the states and to the localities and to individuals. But we often think only of the federal constitution when we think of our constitutional rights.
Building on that, are we living through a resurgence of federalism?
We are living in the golden age of federalism. And this is true not just on, from a center-right perspective, but from a liberal perspective as well. I think the framers could not even have begun to believe how important the federalist design would be in a Balkanized nation of red and blue states, and we get to do our own thing to a large extent, from education policy to health policy to corporate regulation and on and on and on. From healthcare freedom to abortion rights to so many other issues, you can move with your feet now more than and trust me, there's a lot of people moving with their feet to Arizona and to your former state, Texas, as well, because they treasure the greater benefits and freedoms that those states offer.
So a couple of final questions, big picture questions, although I would ask detailed questions for a long time. The first of the final two is, say, pick a time period, 15, 20, 25 years. Maybe you're retired. Maybe not. But no doubt, the two of us will be at the end of our careers. And you look back, not just on what you have done, but you're reflective about Arizona. You're reflective about America, and you say, you tell Shauna one evening, you know what? We got it right. We in the United States got it right. What would we have gotten right? What would have been improved over that period of time from this point to that point? In other words, I'm looking for, some concrete thing, Clint, that audience members can point to and maybe be part of, given your recommendation that it's so important.
Well, certainly, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, and certainly from an Arizona perspective, our freedom of choice in the education arena has just been incredible. And when we moved to Arizona, school choice was in its infancy. I joined the boards of two remarkable charter school organizations, BASIS and the Great Hearts Academies, which now are just, you know, they're national, and they're providing educational opportunities to, you know, tens of thousands of kids. And just looking at that alone, nothing else at all, and knowing that we both played a part in that, as board members, as a legislator in Shauna's case, as a lawyer in my case, it's incredibly gratifying. The other thing, though, is something that I know that you and I share very deeply in common, and that is building freedom institutions. When I think of IJ, we started with 7 employees and a pretty small budget. There are up to 165 people around, staffers around the nation right now. I have long since lost track of the litigation organizations in the freedom movement. Heritage, obviously, you know, I mean, has just grown tremendously, and has increased its scope and influence. TPPF, the Wyoming Catholic College that you were involved in, becoming a part of institutions that will long outlast us, I think is incredibly gratifying. And seeing that they will continue to have an impact long after we're forgotten is about the most gratifying thing that I can think of.
Institution building really is the answer. It's more long-term,
yes,
by its nature than many people think the knife fighting, if you will, of modern day politics suggests. And some of that, if it's legislative, sort of has to happen, going back to your comment about Shauna's work in the legislature, friends' work in Congress. But the point is, while many fellow Americans, certainly friends on the center right, will agree with you and me that institution building is important, they look at some of that knife fighting, they hear the discourse, they watch the news. For that matter, they see the deterioration of institutions in their community around the country. And as you no doubt know, some of these are mutual friends, they're very discouraged. Some of them are even despairing. And yet, I know you just well enough to know you woke up this morning hopeful.
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Well, you know, even as institutions deteriorate, and even as you watch so many people who we would call our friends knife fighting with each other for no good end in many instances, you know, we do have an opportunity to reinvigorate those institutions, people being involved in their churches and community organizations. Those are the things that really matter. And where the institutions have failed, we live in a society where we can create new ones. I mean, just think back to when we were kids. You know, how many TV stations were there? How many newspapers were there? Now, literally anyone can create a news source or an opinion source. And so we need to take advantage of that. And I think trying to check our animosities at the door to the, you know, to the greatest possible extent. You know, Reagan was obviously a hero to me, and the notion that, you know, someone who we agree with 80% of the time is our friend, not our enemy, and we can find common cause to build new institutions, even as some of the old ones disappoint us.
Justice Clint Bullock, thank you for being a great American.
Oh, thank you,
a great
Kevin.
Jurist, and most of all for being a cheerful warrior. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise, thank you so much, and good luck at the helm of the Heritage Foundation.
Thanks so much.
Keep spawning those romances.
We will. It's a vital part of our mission, and
yes,
America depends on it, right?
Yes, indeed.
I told you would enjoy this conversation. You no doubt knew of Justice Bullock before this conversation, but even if you did, you know that there's a lot of depth in his thinking, and obviously a lot of wisdom. We'll take to heart not only his hopefulness about the American future, but the manner by which we can manifest that in our daily work. Thanks for being part of the Kevin Roberts Show. We will see you next time. Remember to keep your chin up. We are winning.
The Kevin Roberts Show is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. The executive producer is Crystal Kate Bonham. The producer is Philip Reynolds. Sound design by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and Tim Kennedy. For more information and to subscribe, please visit heritage.org.